Hello, one and all. Welcome to the Bandit Bulletin. My name is Keith. I am the game designer, proprietor of this podcast. This is the Clockwork Game still, and it has been taken over by the Bandit Bulletin, which you are listening to right now. Today, we are going to be, if you haven't listened to episode one, that's where we got into, you know, what is this game? I'm making an RPG. It's a big deal. I'm probably going to be making this thing for years. And I couldn't be happier that I'm doing it. I'm really, really enjoying the process so much. It's going to be great. Every time I work on it, I'm like more and more hyped about it. This podcast, the Bandit Bulletin, is a chance for me to kind of just talk through a bunch of different things that I've been working on and update you about what I'm thinking about and get you a little more familiar with some of the systems and design thinking behind some of the decisions. So today, first of all, if you haven't listened to the first episode, definitely go listen to that first. And also, you can support this program and the production of this RPG by going to patreon.com/KeithBurgun and, becoming a patron. And it definitely helps a lot, especially right now, because, working on this RPG is like kind of, it's sort of my full-time thing I'm doing right now. So whatever, if anyone wants to help out, pitch in, it really makes a big difference. So today, what are we talking about? We're talking about the skill grid and characters, the relationship between the something that we call the skill grid in this game, which I will explain, and what does that mean for characters? What are the characters like in this game? But before I get into the skill grid stuff, I want to give you an update on the games I've been playing. I've been playing a lot of RPGs. Right now I'm playing three different RPGs. I am playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, and I wanted to just quickly say a few things about that. This is the sequel to Final Fantasy VII Remake, which I've talked about in the past. I really like the combat system in that. I think it's the one like sort of real-time with pause situation I've ever seen that I actually like. And Rebirth takes that same system and really builds on it in a way that I wish actually many Final Fantasy games would do with their sequels, is build on a system and iterate on it rather than necessarily starting from scratch every time. So Final Fantasy VII Rebirth's combat is very cool. It's very complex. It's actually shockingly complex. It's like I almost want to go into a practice mode and like mess around with stuff. It's kind of crazy the amount of stuff that you can do in that. I mean, you don't necessarily have to, especially on the normal difficulty, but the fact that complexity is there is really fun. It makes it feel more toy-like, more of like a fight. I really enjoy the combat. I also have to talk about Queen's Blood. So one of the mini games in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is a card game called Queen's Blood, and it's a little bit in the tradition of like Triple Triad and Tetra Master from 8 and 9, but it's kind of also inspired, I think, by things like Artifact and Marvel Snap. It's got a win two of three lanes concept, but it's actually, so what it does is, I think this is a brilliant thing. And first, in order to talk about this, I'd like to quickly just mention Artifact, Valve's card game that they tried to make. There was one thing about that I really liked, which was, so you can win two of three lanes in Artifact by blowing up two towers first. However, when you blow up a tower, it reveals this, like, I forget, it was like 99 health or something, 90 health, super strong tower behind that tower. And if you can blow that up in one lane, you win that way. So there's actually two victory conditions. You can win two lanes, or you can super win one lane. So Queen's Blood does a similar thing. It's a lane-based game. You're putting down cards into lanes. There's a lot of really cool things about it. It has like a go-like affordances, or not affordances, what do they call it? Liberties sort of system. It's really, really cool in a lot of ways. But the one thing I wanted to just mention about it was, it has a very elegant, almost like Reiner Knizia style rule that that sort of achieves that Artifact two goals thing. Because here's how it works. You're not just trying to win three lanes, best two out of three lanes. You're actually trying to have the highest score, and your score is the total of all of your winning lanes. So lanes that you've tied do not score. Lanes that you lost you get 0 points for. So what that means is you could have like a giant score in one lane and just ignore the other two, which it's, so it kind of gets that really cool. Most of the time you're just going to win two lanes. That's like the normal way to win. However, it is totally possible to get like a huge score on one lane. And so that creates this really interesting strategic choice tension. And I don't know, I've been thinking a lot about that. And it's, you know, I keep sort of running into this pattern in game design where, in strategy game designs, where it actually feels like you want there to be one goal in terms of, like, if we're talking about core mechanism, right? So like in Queen's Blood, it's good that all your cards add value to a lane or somewhere, right? Because that's the core mechanism, is adding value to lanes, right? And so it's good that the goal, both goals have to do with that. However, so it would be bad if like there was some goal, like I would be opposed to some goal that was like, you know, your opponent runs out of cards, like the milling strategy in MTG. I'm not a big fan of those kinds of things. But I find that like having two goals, like Spellstorm, my card game, it kind of has two goals also. And I feel that like sometimes in strategy games, as long as the two goals feel like very tightly related and still sort of surrounding like a core gameplay thing in a very tight way, I find that like two goals might actually sort of be better than one in a weird way. And in any case, that's maybe a whole topic for discussion. That's something that I can investigate more later and I've been thinking about. But for now, Queen's Blood is awesome. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is also awesome. It's very visually beautiful. It's very charming. If I had to complain about anything, I would say that the narrative is a lot weaker in this one than it is in the first one. There's actually very little like narrative stuff going on. Pretty much the whole game has felt pretty homogenous. Like I've just been chasing Sephiroth, this like phantom Sephiroth, the whole entire game. It's plot wise, it's not great. It's kind of feels like a big open area, and it is like an open world thing, and it has some of the kind of features of like a, you know, Ubisoft open world AAA video game. But even with those, it's done very well. I strongly recommend Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Okay, so that's the first game. Second game, I'll be a little faster with the rest of these. Bravely Default I'm playing, and that is for the 3DS. And it's okay. It's kind of like Final Fantasy V in that it takes like a job system and like explodes it. It's like Final Fantasy V 2. That's kind of what it feels like. And it feels that way both in the narrative also and in the gameplay. So the 5 narrative kind of sucked. All your characters were like royalty, and it was just like the bad guy was like a evil, cackling evil guy. It just really was a bad narrative in 5. And this one also feels kind of similar. The narrative has this like sort of instrumental feeling to it where we all know you need to have this in the game. So there's some like thin veneer narrative excuse for why anything's happening. It's not great narratively. The art's cool and the music is also very good. And the gameplay system, it has this Brave/Default thing where you can basically like queue up a bunch of actions all at once if you want to. Like you can have your one guy go 4 times right now, but then he won't be able to go for 4 turns, that kind of thing. Or you can default, which is the opposite. You like stock up extra turns. I personally don't think that that's a very interesting system. Like, I think that that's not really doing so much for the game. But other than that, it's solid. I find myself just wanting to ignore the entire Brave Default thing and just play it like a regular RPG. But I'm sure that, you know, certainly it is advantageous to get 4 turns right now and just kill a guy, you know? Bravely Default seems okay. I'm not sure. We'll see how that goes. I'm not over the moon over it for sure. And then the last game I want to quickly talk about is Unicorn Overlord, which is a strategy RPG, and it's almost more of just a strategy game. It's like a campaign strategy game. There is a story, but the story is garbage, and the narrative and the writing, it's all just it's extremely boring stuff. It doesn't need to be there. It probably should have been more of like a campaign, you know, like a Civ kind of, or it's Crusader Kings kind of presentation. But in any case, the gameplay, the actual, you know, battles are fantastic. It's brilliant. It's brilliant how they've divided up. You have these little 2x3 grids, and they've got all these different unit types that interact with those 2x3 grids in really different ways. It's really very cool. I'm enjoying it a lot. I'm about 12 hours in or so. I'm playing on hard. I recommend people play it on hard, actually, which I don't do often. But for this game, I think you kind of need to play it on hard because a lot of mechanics just don't even make any sense. I was very confused when I was playing it on normal. Like, why would I ever want to use an item? And now on hard, I'm like, oh, okay. I need to use items. I see. So I definitely recommend playing it on hard for most people who are listening to this, probably. But yeah, check out Unicorn Overlord. A lot of really, really cool design ideas in there. And that's about it for my game playing update. So next up, let's actually talk about the skill grid in my upcoming RPG. So the first thing I'll just say outright is that it's very important to me that all of the characters in this world, the world of this RPG, are people. They're treated as people. The NPCs are treated as people. The characters are treated as people. People in the past are treated as people. People of different species are treated as people. That's a very important thing to me. Even if they're like stuffed animal bunnies or if they're potatoes, doesn't matter. They're people, and so they should be treated as people, and there's a lot of different things that means. But for today's purposes, basically what that means is, they're individuals, and part of how you express that individuality is not just what they do in the story and what they say in cutscenes, but also their mechanical role, right? Like, what do they do? So, you know, for example, if a character is a teacher, maybe their role in battle is a little bit more of a support type of thing, or a caster, or, you know, some weird new teacher battle class, you know. Or if, you know, maybe they're a super soldier and then, you know, they have a big sword and or a big gun or whatever. And these things sort of what they do mechanically kind of. Yeah, if the person's a very aggressive person, we have a character named Barton, who is a stuffed animal bunny. Who is very angry and very aggressive. And so his role and his, you know, mechanical role reflects that. He's kind of like a barbarian sort of approach to combat, which matches it helps express who he is. So that's just an overall statement about characters and how mechanics can sort of support them. Having each character have their own special powers is great because it also means that getting new characters really matters. I think a lot about Baldur's Gate 3, which I liked a lot. I really enjoyed Baldur's Gate 3 a lot. But one thing that was sort of sad was once I had a party of four characters, once I had four characters in my roster, getting a fifth sort of meant nothing for me mechanically because I can, with the four characters I have, I can make them all into bards, and then they all are bards, or I can make them all into wizards, or I can do two fighters and two wizards, you know, like I can do anything I want. And a fifth character is really just, now again, I'm speaking like their lore and their appearance aside, it's sort of, it doesn't unlock anything new for me mechanically. And I always felt like that was. Yeah, and so for that reason, I find it a little disappointing when characters are just kind of like these empty husks. I feel a little bit of that way sometimes with Final Fantasy VII as well, less so with the remake and Rebirth. But, you know, Materia, for example, is like a lot of what the characters are, you know, and if you put a bunch of casting Materia onto Cloud, well, okay, now Cloud is kind of a caster. You know, or you can put a bunch of healing stuff on anybody and then they're your healer. That's another example there. Whereas in a lot of games, the healer, it's like you have one healer character, that's who can do the healing, that's it. And so it's sort of tied more to their person. And, you know, in the case of like Aerith, You know, it kind of makes sense for her to be the healer, I think, like, aesthetically. She's, you know, she's dressed all nice and, you know, she's a flower salesperson and she's very, like, kind and gentle. So I think that makes a lot of sense for her to be doing the healing, not necessarily Cloud to be doing the healing. So anyways, you know, that's just an example of how that flexibility is sometimes a... So I want characters in a game to be meaningfully their own thing, and ideally not just stat shifts either. Like, you know, you can, I think Final Fantasy has different stat growth probably for different characters, but seven I'm speaking about, and I think that's not maybe quite enough to do the job, although it's a good thing to have. And I also, though, I also want to be able to build my characters. So there's a little bit of a rub there, right? Because, like, I do like that in Baldur's Gate 3, I do have flexibility. Perhaps this is an issue of I have too much flexibility. But it is important to have that flexibility. To me, a core appeal of RPGs is being able to make decisions about character creation, about party management. I mean, I feel like party management is, like, core to what an RPG is. So we have that sort of rub there, that conflict. Because on the one hand, I want my characters to be people. Their identities somewhat fixed, right? Because I don't want the priest lady who's becoming a glass cannon or like a ninja or whatever. On the other hand, I do want to have choices about what my characters are like and how I build them. So with all that out of the way, let's talk about the skill grid. So I was very inspired by Final Fantasy X's really amazing sphere grid. If you haven't seen it, go look it up online. Also, I'd say go play Final Fantasy X. It's good. It's one of the better Final Fantasy games. But in any case, for now, like, just imagine a big web of spiraling nodes that are interconnected. Each character that you get in your party starts on a different space in this node, and each node either has a skill or a stat boost on it, and the nodes are also kind of clustered for types of skills. So all the black mage skills are sort of in one area, all the fighter skills are in one area, and they're sort of placed around in a way that, like, kind of makes sense, right? Like, so you don't put very unlike things very adjacent to each other. You put more similar things closer to each other in general. So, like, next to the fighter is, like, more of like a sort of paladin-y kind of person, and and white mage and black mage are on their own side, sort of. So that creates, what it does is it takes a job system, like a classical job system, but it makes it spatial. Jobs are now connected to other jobs, or not connected to them, or distantly connected, or closely connected. And you might have to really go out of your way to get from one job to another job, like black mage versus fighter, whereas paladin and healer might be adjacent, for example. So when I first saw the Final Fantasy X sphere grid, my brain really lit up. I think it's such an exciting idea. There are also a few neat things that you can do in Final Fantasy X. Like, there are special items that let you learn a skill that an ally has already learned, and ones that let you teleport around and things like that. But I would say that also in general, despite how amazing it is, I was broadly a little bit disappointed in how Final Fantasy X used the sphere grid, just because I feel like it could be so much more. The Final Fantasy X sphere grid felt like the first stab at this kind of a system for an RPG. It's just like, it's very elemental. It's like just enough to make it work. And I should say, a side note, but this is one of those like pet peeves I have with the Final Fantasy series. There is a Final Fantasy X-2, you may understand, or you may already know. And you might be thinking, like, well, maybe they took, for Final Fantasy X-2, they took that system and they kind of developed it. They developed the sphere grid. And in Final Fantasy X-2, there's like a more advanced, more complex sphere grid. And sadly, the answer is no, because even though it's X-2, they kind of do the thing that they always do, which is sort of start over from scratch. And they have a completely different system. There's some like vague connections to a sphere grid, but it's totally different. They have the thing called a dress sphere, and I can't talk too much about it because I didn't play that game very much. It didn't really pull me in, but in any case, there was not more development on the sphere grid done in Final Fantasy X-2 or in Final Fantasy XII or in XIII. And so it's really something that hasn't really been developed. There are some other examples of games with a grid like this. The most prominent is probably Path of Exile, But that's a pretty different game, and its approach is also very different. And it's not a party-based game. So there's all kinds of ways in which that's not necessarily the best comparison, but it's worth noting. So, for Free Tia Bannet, we're doing something like the Sphere Grid. We're going to call it the Skill Grid, and it's kind of like the Sphere Grid, but with a few really important differences. So let me just quickly go through my core values for the Skill Grid. These are the things I care most about. Number one, a given character should, by the end of a normal playthrough, have gained access to maybe a third or so of the Skill Grid. Possibly even less, like 25% of the Skill Grid sounds pretty good to me for most characters. Depending on how long that you've had them in your party, and your main character would probably be able to explore more of a little more of it because he's been around the longest, but no character should have anything like 50, 60, 70% of the Skill Grid unlocked. Of course, there would be ways for players to eventually 100% it, but that would only be achieved through very like intense, deliberate completionist behavior. So, you know, the people who play games for 200, 300 hours to kind of get every 100% of the things in the game. Okay, so that's point one. The second point is that I think there should be hidden information, like Fog of War, actually, on the Skill Grid. You should only see a small part of the Skill Grid when you start and only have one or two characters. You can just see the area around them. You have to like move around it in order to discover all of its parts. But that said, there are vague pointers telling you like over, you know, to the north of you right now is the Black Mage stuff, or over to the west is fighter stuff, so that you have and to the east is White Mage stuff, so that you kind of like know what it means to go west or what it means to go north in a broad way, but you don't, you're not like, what I don't want is people to be like, you know, plotting out their whole route. I want it to be kind of, you know, you look at what you have in front of you and you make a decision. At some point you will have unlocked most of the grid. You know, you'll have seen between all of your characters, you will see almost all the grid. Maybe some players will see all of the grid. But by that point, it'll be kind of mid late game. There are also like secret nodes and entire sections of the Skill Grid that are blocked off and you wouldn't even know that they're there. And some people will play through the game and beat the game and not even know there was a whole nother section to it. It should be messy and naturalistic, something that the Final Fantasy X one doesn't have going on at all. So what I mean by that is like there's different ways that you're able to access different parts of the grid, many of which are just blocked off or hidden until you do a certain relevant thing, and I'll talk about that in a second. There should be enough nodes in one single job, sort of, like let's say Thief, for example, so that you can really just spend most of the game maxing out that one job if you want. Like, you don't have to cross-class if you don't want to, which I think was kind of not so much the case in Final Fantasy X from what I remember. You kind of had to, there wasn't that much within one type of thing. So basically the Skill Grid should be a way for the player to get more powerful in their own weird way as they play. A certain amount of largeness of the Sphere Grid, and I think that ours is going to have to be bigger than Final Fantasy X's, is required so that players only unlock a certain amount of it, and so that meeting a new character will, at least most times, reveal a new part of the grid for you. So that's one of the reasons that meeting new characters will be exciting to get in this game, because, you know, your map, so to speak, will expand because you're like, oh wow, there's this whole section down here. I didn't even think it went down that far. And then look, there's a person that is down there, and I can maybe connect. I can move up this way, and I can get them some of the thief skills, etc. Like, there's so much excitement there, and not to mention, you could find a secret character who actually themselves unlocks a secret part of the Skill Grid that you otherwise wouldn't be able to find. So let's talk about parts of the Skill Grid. There are currently 10, for lack of a better term, jobs or classes around which I've organized the skills. So, you know, things like fighter, healer, and of course the main character's class, which is thief. The main character is like a thief rogue type, and so they will start in that part of the skill grid. There are also 10 playable characters, so 10 jobs or 10 classes and 10 playable characters, each of which start in one part of this skill grid. Of the 10 playable characters, 6 of them are going to be kind of like the core cast. So every playthrough we'll get those in your party. They'll have important, like, you know, main story roles to play, things like that. And then there'll be 2 characters who are kind of extra. So you can either get them, but they're sort of optional. Maybe you could miss them. Maybe one is only there for part of the game, but then disappears, etc. They're kind of like, you know, they're tertiary. And then there will be 2 characters who are like actual bona fide secret characters, and they are definitely easy to miss. Like, you could go through the whole game and not even know they were there. Secrets are something that's really important to me, and this game will have lots of secrets of many different kinds and many different levels. Maybe that's something for a whole show, but, you know, a secret can be, really quickly, I'll just say, like, a secret could be in these open world games, you know, the lightest version of a secret is like just that there's some resources that you can collect over behind a ridge or something. It's not really secret, but maybe you wouldn't look there. And then, like, a little more secret is like, maybe you have to put a bomb and blow up a wall, and then there's some stuff behind there. And then a little more secret is, you know, maybe you have to answer a specific question in a certain way when you do some dialogue options, and then that unlocks a certain quest or something. And then even more secret, like, you know, you can go really kind of hard with the secrets, and you have to do a weird thing that you would maybe never even know about, unless you were told about it or found out somehow by accident. So I want to have all levels of secret in this game. I think that really is important, and the skill grid is no exception to that. I'll just mention really quickly also, each character has like a signature weapon, kind of like Final Fantasy VII style, that they and only they can equip. And in addition to this, there is an equip swords node somewhere on the skill grid that anyone could theoretically unlock, which gives any character who gets that node or unlocks that node the ability to use a sword. And there's a lot of swords in the game. Like, it's a common weapon type. So that would be pretty nice if you can reach that. So how does it work? Whenever you level up, you get SP skill points, which allow you to travel around on the skill grid, unlocking stuff as you go. Stat nodes that increase your attack or whatever stat, cost a small amount of SP, while skills and rolls, and we'll talk about rolls and all that whole stuff probably in a future show, cost more. Normally, once you clear a node, it's free to move through afterwards. However, there are also gate nodes, which cost something to move through every single time you move through them. In addition to that, there are also stat nodes have a chance to kind of come back to life and be something you have to clear again after being cleared, after you clear other nodes. So, like, let's say you clear a whole big section of the sphere grid and you're all the way at the east corner of it. And you're like, you know what? I kind of want to go back all the way to the west side of this giant area I've cleared. Well, you can't just necessarily just run right over there without paying anything. There may be gate nodes on the way, and there may also be new, like, stat nodes that have, like, replenished themselves, which is like, okay, you get some extra stats. That's cool. But, it will slow you down. There are also class gate nodes. These are nodes that you cannot pass through without a certain class key, which you would get as part of, like, the in the world. So, for example, like, it's very hard to get into the ninja part of the skill grid without having a ninja class key, which, I don't know, maybe some NPC will give you, or you'll find it in some sort of secret treasure chest somewhere or something. There's only one or two of them in the whole game, and they're kind of hard to find. But, you know, that's another kind of neat thing where maybe you can get around the class node, gate node, if, by meeting an actual ninja playable character, and, you know, then you get through that way, at least with him. So yeah, these are all just a starting point to the design. One year from now, I might listen to this podcast and be like, wow, this is all irrelevant now. And that's how game design tends to go, at least for me. But, you know, that's where I'm at now. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Have you played any games other than Final Fantasy X or Path of Exile that have a skill grid like this, especially RPGs? I'm very interested to hear more about that. And if so, I know a lot of games have skill trees, and some trees are pretty big, but I still feel like it's not quite the same thing as the Final Fantasy X sphere grid, where you have multiple characters all moving around in a sort of non-linear, like almost directionless kind of way. Like you choose the direction, whereas a tree, trees always have a direction that you're supposed to go, right? Like they go up or they go down. So yeah, if you have any good recommendations for different kinds of skill grids in games, let me know. I'd love to hear about it. Yeah, and other than that, I'll just quickly give a quick development update. The development on the RPG is going great. Actually, before I even mention that, I need to just say April 17th, the Spellstorm Kickstarter is going live. So if you haven't already signed up on Kickstarters on the Kickstarter page, definitely do so, because then you'll get an alert when the Kickstarter goes live. So yeah, I'm very excited for that. I've actually been doing a lot of Spellstorm work, a lot of playtesting. The game is coming along awesome, and it's cool because there's actually like plot stuff that connects between Spellstorm, that connects between Gem Wizards Tactics and Spellstorm and Free Tia Bandit, and another project that I've been working on. More on that later, but yeah, the development on this RPG is going great. I have a mini game that's fully coded and awesome. The game now saves and loads. Saving and loading is all pretty much in there. We have the combat system is all like done basically. And so now it's like largely, we're almost to the point where it's really just about, well, we have the area map, which is like where you're walking around in towns and stuff like that. We have some mechanics to do there, but, and then like the, what else? The, your in-game menu, you know, where you look at your items and you equip things and all that stuff. Like that's going to be a lot. So that's another thing. But, other than that, it's getting to the point where we can start actually really doing content, which I'm very excited for. Yeah, that's about it for today's Bandit Bulletin. Thank you for listening. And again, you can support this and my work on this RPG and this podcast by going to patreon.com/KeithBurgun. And otherwise, I will catch you around on the Discord. Thanks for listening.